And we are going. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. With that, I'd like to call to order the Kaiser City Council for a work session. It is Wednesday, May 19th, 2021. And Debbie, you have the attendance of the city councilors.
Already I am keeping track of everybody, yes. All right.
So quick, I just got a response from Commissioner Watson. I guess there's probably some folks that are in the waiting room that haven't been admitted yet. He is one of them. So I'd imagine probably Commissioner Callier and some others maybe as well.
There's one.
Yeah, so I saw Councillor Day on there, mm-hmm. Commissioner Callier.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, and so Commissioner Watson's on there as well, okay. Even though it's his wife's picture.
I could see you.
That doesn't look like him.
I could see you. I could hear you.
We're not going to get into that.
But it couldn't be me.
All right, Mr. Lawyer, do you want to convene or call to order the Planning Commission?
Yes, Madam Mayor, thank you. Call the meeting of the Planning Commission work session to order at 6:03.
Thank you very much. So this evening we'll be talking about our housing needs analysis, buildable lands inventory. And I'll turn it over to Shane Witham, our Planning Director, and Shannon Johnson, our city attorney, to direct us from there with our consultants. You're on.
All right, thank you, Mayor Clark. So tonight we are here to, you know, we met back in February, I believe it was, with kind of an initial look at our housing needs analysis, buildable lands inventory. We said we'd be coming back to you with some updates. So that is what the purpose of this meeting is. Our consultant is with us, Beth Goodman with Echo Northwest. They've been doing the technical work for us on this and crunching numbers and all of that fun stuff. So really without much further ado, I'm gonna turn it over to Beth. She's gonna walk through a presentation with us. And basically as we go, I think that format wise, if you have questions in the midst, I think if you want to use the raise hand feature, I can call on you, or Beth will see that and can call on you. And, you know, we can also just go with the good old fashioned unmute yourself and say, excuse me, I have a question. And I think we're fine with just kind of having it be, yeah, wave your hands, whatever works. I think we're fine with it being fairly, you know, open and low key to just saying, hey, here's what it is and here's the questions. So without much more from me, Beth, you can take it away.
Thank you very much, Shane. Shane, will you or somebody enable it so that I can share my screen? While Shane's doing that, as Shane said, you'll probably have some questions as we go through. And let me be the first person to say that some parts of Oregon's land use system don't necessarily make sense. I will explain them as well as I can and answer your questions as well as I can. But there is a point at which, after which I only have so much to offer. So I'll offer everything I have, certainly to answer your questions.
And Beth, you should be able to share now.
Thank you so much. All right. So obviously here we are going to revisit the issue of Kaiser's housing needs. What we're going to do is we're going to go through an update of the project since February 2021, give you some more information about the buildable lands update, and then some preliminary forecasts for new population growth and new housing, and then land sufficiency. Do you have enough land or not? And then the final report, we're expecting to revise what we've got here based on the new population forecast that'll come out at the end of June. And then we'll get you a final report in the summer. So an overview of what we've done and why we're doing it. We're still trying to answer the questions about how much growth will there be in the next 20 years. We know at this point how much land does Kaiser have and where is buildable land. Does Kaiser have enough buildable residential land to accommodate expected growth? At this point, the answer is no, and we'll talk about that in some detail. And then what policies are needed to meet Kaiser's housing needs? Well, you guys have done some of those with the implementation of the RCOD, and we'll also be updating the other housing policy analysis from the 2019 report. So again, we're focused partially on the substantial changes resulting from the River Cherry Overlay District, which I always forget the order of those, so I'll just call it the RCOD, as well as changes to the population forecast. So one of the things that we are doing is coordinating the land needs with City of Salem, and the discussion is ongoing with City of Salem. We'll probably resume after we have the final population forecast. Salem recently adopted their vision for development, and they think that they have capacity within the urban growth boundary to accommodate additional single family housing and missing middle housing types. And missing middle housing types, if you aren't already overly familiar with that, are things like cottage housing, townhouses, duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes, those kind of housing types. And then there'll be continued discussions that are beyond my scope about formalizing the coordination with City of Salem. Before I go and talk about buildable lands inventory, does anybody have any questions they want to discuss first?
I do. What? Who is discussing what? It says discussion is ongoing with the City of Salem. Who's discussing with the City of Salem, and what are they discussing, and on whose behalf?
Yeah, I can answer that, Councillor Day. Basically, I am discussing with City of Salem. When we did our housing needs analysis in 2019, for example, we had some meetings with Salem because we had to talk about population. And, you know, prior to Portland State having a specific number for Kaiser, there was discussion about, you know, a population split and how we plan for our housing needs analysis moving forward. With a shared urban growth boundary, essentially the state requires that we coordinate, and our comprehensive plan requires coordination with Salem whenever we go through these processes. So, for example, if we roll back all the way to 2013, I believe it was, when the last housing needs analysis and buildable lands inventory was done, we showed that we had a lack of available lands, but because of the dynamic of the shared UGB and the fact that there was capacity within the overall UGB, the coordination was essentially, I mean, they have enough room. I think it'd be a little bit different conversation if there wasn't capacity in the UGB, but specifically with Salem, since they're in the midst of a comprehensive plan update for their R Salem project, the coordination has really been, okay, what is it that your land supply is looking like and your capacity is looking like in relation to their share of the UGB versus our share of the UGB and how those things kind of connect. So it's not, I mean, I would say it's not like anything of a formalized negotiations, right, by any means. It's a matter of more fact finding at this stage.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Are there any other questions at this point? So talking about buildable lands inventory, not much has changed since we talked in February about this. So as a reminder, what we did in, before February, was we looked at development that had happened within Kaiser since the 2019 buildable lands inventory was done. We also added in the RCOD, which you can see in the purple dotted line, and began organizing the amount of land based on inside of the RCOD and outside of the RCOD, so that we could make different capacity assumptions for inside the RCOD and outside, because there's different allowable development densities inside and outside. And so what we found is there are about 234 buildable acres. 185 of that is outside the RCOD, and 49 of that is inside the RCOD. Your low density areas have the most vacant buildable land as any other areas. Little change from the 2019 buildable lands inventory, which showed 253 residential acres. So we're seeing about the same acres, a little bit less, and then we know what's inside and outside the RCOD. Are there any questions about the buildable lands inventory before we go on? Okay. So then what we've got here are the 2017 population forecast, what would the amount of growth that we would see between 2021 and 2041, and then a preliminary estimate of growth over the same period from the new 2021 forecast. So that forecast is not yet finalized. We had a draft of it back in March. There are still items under discussion before finalizing it. It's expected to be done, it's legally must be done by June 30th of this year. So back in 2017, we had a forecast of about 9,958 new people in Kaiser. And here in 2021, we're looking at a forecast of 4,586 new people in Kaiser. When we look at PSU's forecast overall for Marion County, the draft forecasts were significantly lower in the new forecast than they were in the 2017 forecast. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the reasons for that is that population growth overall population growth is the result of two different things. One is natural increase. So when you have more births than you have deaths, you see population growth. And two is from in-migration, where people move to Kaiser from a different city in Oregon, a different county in Oregon, from a different state in the US, or from outside of the US. We're seeing lower natural increase. So this is mostly a result of one, lower fertility, so fewer births. And then also too, our population of older people is comparatively large. And of course, so you'll see more deaths over the next 20 years. And then the other bigger point is about in-migration. PSU is expecting in-migration to slow in Marion County. And I've seen this in a number of their other forecasts. They're expecting it to slow across Oregon. So are there questions about the population forecast? I see Mr. Johnson.
Thanks. What is AAGR?
Average annual growth rate. Average annual growth rate is essentially the compounded growth rate per year over the 20-year period.
And are you going to get into explaining why the allocation dropped so much too?
I don't have a good explanation about why the allocation dropped so much.
Okay, thank you.
I would say this. I mean, the one thing that I will say about the allocation that I want to kind of remind everybody on, historically, when Kaiser has done long-range planning and population projections, prior to the rules being changed through legislation that established PSU as the basically, hey, they're the Bible of population now. It's just they are the ones that do population projections. Prior to that, counties did coordinated population forecasts. And so when we did those coordinated population forecasts, there was, I wasn't involved with those, but my understanding is that they would look at things like growth rates and development potentials and all of those things, and then essentially assign, okay, this area is going to get this much growth, this area is going to get this much growth based on a larger number. PSU has changed some of their methodologies, and I've sat through a couple of webinars on that. Councilor Duran was at one of them with me a while back. So there have been some changes to the way they do the forecasting for consistency throughout the state. But the one thing I would want to kind of point out is that, you know, historically when we had selected a X amount of percent of the overall population that would be in Kaiser, it really was not a mathematically derived number as much as it was, this is the percentage that we're going to have of the population that we kind of presupposed, so to speak.
And Shane, I'll feed into that because I was part of some of those discussions back in 2010, 11, and 12. Previously, we estimated that about 15.6% of the Salem Kaiser's UGB population was within Kaiser. And that was based on some work that I believe Marion County staff did, looking specifically at how much of the population was in Kaiser's portion of the UGB. So it had a foundation at that point, and that's been the percent that we've been assuming ever since. When PSU is dividing the forecast into Kaiser and Salem, they're not necessarily using that percentage. PSU is also looking at things like historical growth rates and how much housing a city has seen growth of over the last 5 years. So Kaiser has obviously seen less growth over the last 5 years, and that is one of PSU's considerations. Exactly how that fits in isn't entirely clear.
I don't know how to raise my hand on here, but
you're good.
Is part of that based on that we don't have land to build? Is that, I mean, I would guess that our population would have grown more than it has if there were places where people could live.
And that is certainly part of the discussion. It's a point that I've brought up with PSU in a number of meetings, and it's a chicken and egg issue. If you don't have land to build on, how can you have much growth? So if your population forecast is based on how much growth you've been having, it's going to perpetuate historical trends. And so I think your point is very much on point.
Chair Lawyer.
Yeah, thanks, Shane. So, and if I didn't see this, I apologize, but are we seeing what Salem's buildable land numbers are? Because I've heard estimates to the degree of, you know, over 2,000 acres for Salem. Is that anywhere in this document?
It is not anywhere in this document. I haven't looked currently at where their buildable lands numbers were, but they had a big surplus when we did their housing needs analysis back in, I think it was 2014, and I believe it was a surplus in the thousands of acres, around 2,000 acres, sounds about right. They've done some work since then, and I haven't caught up on exactly what they're finding now, but they've got a lot of buildable land. They've got a lot of vacant land for single family housing. They had a deficit of land for multifamily housing.
So the gross UGB is moderately healthy, but in terms of Kaiser's footprint, clearly that's not the case.
You guys just don't have a lot of buildable land, and it's really scattered around. You've got some little pockets of it, but otherwise you've got a lot of small parcels. So yeah.
Mayor Clark, you have your hand up.
Oh, okay, thank you. So we have a certain amount of land within our current urban growth boundary. And if we determine that we don't need to designate more for residential, would that open up opportunities for us to designate those lands for mixed use, commercial, retail, and other employment types of land uses that would be close in to allow for people to live and work in the same community?
Well, that's an interesting question. Can we return to it once we get to the answer here? I will say that you've done some of that with inside the RCOD with this piece of land here. And there's an expectation that some more of that might well happen with this piece of land here if the owner is interested in the future in developing it. It might be an opportunity for mixed use development. And that would, of course, be a discussion with the owner of the land. So yes, let's return to that if that's okay.
Okay.
Are there other questions right now about the population forecast? I want to note that the actual forecast may be lower than this estimate. So as I said, the discussions are ongoing with PSU. And PSU has the responsibility to develop a population forecast. And Kaiser is required to work with that forecast. Okay, I'm going to go on then. So here I'm going to talk about changing that 4,000 people, 4,586 down into households. We've talked about this a few times before. We take out a little bit of people for group quarters, which we'll add back in later. We look at your average household size. That comes up to a number of new occupied dwelling units. We use a vacancy rate that's from the census to say, in addition to these occupied units, we need 92 units for a vacancy rate that is about 5.5%. And so that means we're looking at about 1,768 units over the next 20 years. Obviously, with the higher population forecast, you were looking at 3,800 new units over the next 20 years. This will change depending on the change to the population forecast. So we're only talking very briefly about need for affordable housing, but here's a reminder that all households need affordable housing. What we've done here is we've looked at housing affordability in income categories that are related to the median family income in the Salem-Keizer region. 13% of your existing households are in this extremely low income category, and 11% are in the very low income category. Using those percentages with the 1,700 new households, you'd have approximately this number of new households in those income categories. And then up here at the high end, you can see 37% of your households are in high income, have high income comparatively. And so about 648 households of your new households will be in this high income category.
I have a question. I don't know if now's a good time, but how does this compare to our demographics as far as, you know, if we have 13% housing in extremely low income, how many percentage of our population is that in that category? Is that part of this equation?
Well, I could tell you more in terms of existing households. I don't have population right now. Shane, how many people are in Keizer? I don't remember this off the top of my head.
I don't know what the exact number is this year. Does anybody know? I think it's like 39,000, 38 something.
About 39,000-ish.
So 39,000 times 13%. That is the wrong number. That's about 5,070 people who would be in this extremely low income group. Of course, it's a different number of households because you have to adjust for household size. So does that answer your question?
I guess the bottom line of that question is, you know, we have X number of, you know, extremely low income housing versus how many people need the extremely low income housing. That's kind of where I was getting on that as far as the deficit between how many people we have versus how much housing we have. So That's kind of where I was more going with that question. I wasn't very clear about that. I apologize.
No, that's okay. I can answer your question a little bit better here in just a moment if you let me get one thing opened here. You might look at it in terms of cost burden. And so I'm just going to show you a spreadsheet here that's got a graph on it. And so just looking at it in terms of cost burden, what we see is about 23% of your households are cost burdened. And that means that they spend 30% or more of their income on housing costs. When you look at it for renters, it's more than 50%. I think that's 53% of your households are cost burdened. Of them, 26% are severely cost burdened, meaning that they spend 50% or more of their income on housing costs. So what we're seeing here is a high rate of cost burden for renters, which is honestly what we see for most cities in the Willamette Valley, and then a lower rate for cost burden for owners. And that really fits with what we're seeing here. You guys have a little bit higher of a percentage of households in this high income category than you see in a lot of cities. I think that's partially a reflection of the fact that you've probably got some long-term residents and long-term households in Kaiser. And if you've been there for a long, long time, your housing is comparatively more affordable because you presumably bought it a long time ago. And so I think that's partially what we're seeing here. And then certainly households in these categories here, from low income down to extremely low income, are more likely to be among the renters who are cost burdened and severely cost burdened. Does that help answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Certainly.
Mayor Clark, go ahead.
Thank you. So as you pointed out, the households in the middle income and high income, by and large, are home owners. And the ones who are in the extremely low, very low, are by and large renters. And the cost to own, and Councilor Smith, Council President Smith can correct me if I'm wrong, oftentimes is less than a rent, unless it is subsidized.
So, not always. I mean, it depends on the housing costs.
Yes, it does depend if it's on the housing cost, but usually with home ownership, oftentimes the mortgage that you're paying is a little bit less than what you're looking at some of the rent payments, unless you can share across several working adults within that apartment. So my point, though, is that with the nexus of a lot of stock in Kaiser being single family residential, which by and large is home owner occupied, that's going to change the distribution owner to renter, simply because of what we already have here and what we tend to build here is more with the intention of being owner occupied. So is that addressed at some point?
Well, not in this presentation. It's certainly addressed in the housing needs analysis. Let me bring up a little bit of information from the housing needs analysis. When we look in 2020 at average sales prices in Kaiser, what we're seeing is average sales prices around $335,000. And I'm doing this off the top of my head a little bit. Rents in Kaiser, upwards of $1,000 a month or more. And then when we come down here, I will get down here eventually. So these are the categories of income that we were just looking at that are related to this table. And this is about existing households. And so when we look at this highest income group, at the top of what they can typically afford is your average sales price. So people in this income category, 120% or higher, I will agree that they can generally afford your average sales prices. Your middle income households, probably some of them at the top of the in their income category. Here, let me get down here where I can show middle income households a little bit better. So this is households earning between 80% and 120% of median family income. Some of the folks in this category will be able to afford homeownership, but some of them certainly won't. When you're down here between 80 and 50% of median family income, you're certainly going to look, generally speaking, at renter households. But some of these middle income households will also be renter households. So it's not quite as you were describing there, Mrs. Mayor, Ms. Mayor. So still a lot of your middle income households may not be able to afford the cost of a house in Kaiser.
Thank you.
Councilor Smith.
Yeah, I just wanted to note on those numbers that you were just looking at, that's a 30% front end ratio, meaning 30% of your income monthly pre-taxes would be going to the mortgage payment. I will say that lenders go much higher than that. We can definitely, that's a guideline by Fannie and Freddie to have that 30% ratio, which is what they're basing those numbers on. But there could be that could be a little bit different just based on the actual lending out there that's allowed.
And so this number here, this monthly rent, is definitely a 30% number. This number here is 3.5 times median family income, and the bottom one is 4 times. And that's really to account for the fact that some lenders will lend above that.
Yeah.
And so this number here, where it's 4 times a household income, probably isn't all that conservative. It may be a little bit conservative, but it's probably not extremely conservative. Down here, when we look at the sales prices, these are only 3 times. So this is essentially at the 1/3 for these households because their incomes are so low.
Yep.
So, yes, ma'am.
Chair Lawyer.
So my question, I guess, on these, so these are just reflected based off of income and general affordability of the house, right? This is not a reflection of what the actual market is that correct?
Well, we've got actual market numbers up here in the housing needs analysis. Better numbers for ownership than for rent, because we haven't done an intense rent survey for this. But this is certainly reflective of the housing market. These numbers here are meant to be estimates and to give a range of affordability, assuming that a household doesn't cost burden itself. And we know, of course, that many households are cost burdened. Especially the households in the lower income, they're cost burdened by necessity because they can't find housing that's affordable.
Yeah, I'm just really curious because, it's what I'm experiencing in the real world. 6 years ago when we were renting, we were paying over $1,800 a month for a 3-bedroom apartment. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a super great apartment. And, houses in my neighborhood are selling for well over $60,000 of asking prices. So we're getting close to the, $450,000 range on homes. And so I'm just kind of seems to me, and I get that this is sort of a median number, right? So houses mm-hmm. might be listing for 180 or probably selling for 260 or something along mm-hmm. those lines. But it just kind of feels like there's something missing. Like it's not a super great reflection. And it's probably close in terms of law of averages, it's probably really close, but I don't know.
So what I would say is this is a long range planning document. This isn't a document that's meant to be a market analysis for building a specific thing. If I was going to say build a new multifamily structure, if I was proposing to do that, I would do a market analysis that's very different than this and much more detailed and much more reflective of exactly what's happening in the housing market right now. What's really important from this, from a long range perspective, is understanding that you've got these low income and very low income households and some middle and high income households. And there's unmet housing need. In other words, these households are almost certainly among the ones who are cost burdened. And we've got cost burden data in here. And what does this mean for the city, for what it's going to choose to do, if anything, to support development of housing that's affordable, say, you know, below this, well, certainly below 50% of median family housing households income. And then at this 50 to 80%, developing new housing that's affordable in that income range usually isn't financially feasible. And so does the city choose to take any actions to support that kind of housing? And that discussion is really in the housing strategy report that we're not talking about in detail right here. But that's a part of the housing needs analysis.
So in lay terms, does the city choose to eliminate or reduce SECs or subsidize the cost of housing in order to accomplish the goal?
Sure. Those are some options. Tax exemptions, property tax exemptions for a period of time for newly developed housing. There's a lot of different things that cities do around this, but subsidizing SDCs for certain types of development is certainly one of them, or property tax exemptions for newly developed
housing. Because I just think in the real world, it's a projection, but I think in the real world we're dealing with right now, your lumber costs and construction costs are so exponentially high compared to probably when this report was drafted. That, I mean, it's you're talking, and I'm just going to guesstimate here, but I've heard, you know, pre-fire last year it was $150 a square foot, and we've heard that especially on the high end you're looking at upwards of $400 per square foot. So that's a significant increase, which, you know, then that trickles down in terms of the cost to the renter or the homeowner and all those other things. So it's just like, it's kind of a nightmare. Granted, that's a point in time right now. This is looking at 20 years from now, but I think that somebody coming into the market right now under these prices, they're not going to be necessarily driven to say, okay, we're going to build this, you know, $400,000 home and sell it for $200,000.
I won't. Well, of course they wouldn't. That's not financially feasible.
Right.
And I won't disagree with you on any of those things. Having recently bought a bunch of lumber for building a shed in my home. But I will point out this is a long-term forecast and this is a long-term document. The city will be required to do a new housing needs analysis in about 8 years. The city can choose to do one sooner. The use of a housing needs analysis is really, in my opinion, for a city, in addition to understanding its land base and making decisions about that, and choosing to do things like implementing something like the RCOD. The use of a housing needs analysis is also to help the city have discussions about what is it willing to do to support development of affordable housing. And when I say affordable housing, I don't just mean income restricted. I also mean low income housing, certainly. And if the city wants to, it can also choose to do things to support affordable home ownership. These are all options for the city to consider. But that is, in my opinion, the better use of a housing needs analysis. And that discussion happened back in 2019 with the Project Advisory Committee. And there's a housing strategy that Kaiser has that we'll be updating slightly based on the new housing needs analysis, that the city can begin implementing pieces from it sooner than later if it chooses to.
Yeah, I appreciate you entertaining my hypotheticals. Thank you.
Certainly. Madam Mayor?
Oh, thank you. So since we have to look at our housing supply beyond our borders. We have to look at the Salem-Keizer area as a whole. Should we also look at this distribution as well and look at the resources that are available in the Salem housing supply? I mean, across the board, we know that the Salem-Keizer UGB area has significant limitations. But to say that we need to take on a certain percentage when we don't have the land, we don't have the infrastructure, and our tax base is so low, it is the gift that keeps on giving, then where do we enter the conversation about where affordable housing can reasonably be built and managed within the shared UGB? Why is there an, we have to take a certain percentage of each type within our city limits when we are not planning just for city limits?
We're not talking about taking in a certain percentage of this. We're just saying that here in the future, if your new households have the same income distribution as your existing ones, this is the new this is how many new households you'd have in each of these income groups. What you do with that is part of the response to the housing needs analysis. I agree that discussion of affordable housing and where to build it should certainly be part of a regional discussion. How about I finish up what I've got to show you here, and then we can continue discussing the regional questions. Okay. So zooming back down to Keizer and looking at the forecast for new housing, we have inserted the new number of dwelling units. We've left the types of units the same from what we did in 2019. We simply split out the duplex units from the multifamily units, where you've got five or more units per structure to show what we'd be expecting in the future. That's part of being able to understand how much missing middle housing the city may need over the next 20 years. So these splits are what we were working with before. We assumed a certain number of accessory dwelling units would occur, and I believe that was based on historical development trends. And then we assumed a certain amount of redevelopment would occur. So multifamily housing, say in place of where you have single family housing, a single family unit is demolished and more than two units are built there in the future. At 160 units of that, you might think about this in terms of say four multifamily buildings with 40 units or more is an example. And then we reduced these numbers. We took the ADUs out of the single family detached and the 160 multifamily out of the multifamily with five or more units. So if you hold on to this information for a moment, this is a complicated set of assumptions. It's not different from what we brought you back in February, but we looked at density, so how much housing is going to be on your existing land. We assumed density, like the 6.3 dwelling units per net acre. That's based on development in the LDR plan designation outside of the RCOD. Inside of the RCOD, we chose an average number that was between the highest and the lowest that was allowed there. So in RS in LDR, it allows 6 to 10 dwelling units per acre. So we chose an average of 8. And so that's the kind of way we got to each of these density assumptions. And these are net densities. They don't include land for rights of way. So we looked at how much land is in your existing rights of way. And we reduce your densities so that your densities now account for land and rights of way. And that makes it comparable to your buildable lands inventory, which where you've got pieces of land that don't have lands for rights of way, you'd need that eventually. And so we use these densities here against the buildable acres. So for instance, inside the RCOD, we had 19 buildable acres times 6.3 dwelling units per gross acre. That's a capacity of 119 dwelling units. And so that's how we came to do all of these pieces of math. And then with that, we put it all together, and in the background, there's tables about the RCOD and not the RCOD, but we've just summarized it here. And essentially, in the end, in low-density residential, you've got a small deficit of about 26 dwelling units. In your medium-density residential, where you have hardly any land at all, you, of course, have a larger deficit of about 184 units. And then you've got surpluses, not big ones, but surpluses in your mixed use and your MDHR, based on, frankly, based on your changes that you made to your RCOD. That's why you're seeing these slight surpluses. So your deficit is for, I can't do the math in my head, even though I should be able to, but for a little more than 200 dwelling units with this population forecast. And then the question would be, how are you going to accommodate those 200 dwelling units? And that's where the discussions with Salem come in. Can those be accommodated somewhere in the urban growth boundary? Madam Mayor, if you're speaking aloud, you're muted. So then let's entertain any of the broader questions that we had.
Commissioner Watson.
Thank you very much. Shane, maybe you can help me out here if I'm not oversimplifying too much in my head. A capacity deficit of 210 dwelling units is a problem we all need to work together to solve. However, this is significantly less than what we thought we were going to be dealing with last year, thanks to the revised population numbers, correct? I mean, go ahead.
No, I would say yes, you're absolutely correct. You know, and just as a reminder, this update was, you know, it was triggered in order to look at what kind of efficiency measures we actually realized with the adoption of the Kaiser Revitalization Plan and the River Cherry Overlay District. Now, we saw back in February that the work we did there, it did improve our deficits and provide some capacity, but not near the kind of capacity that literally growing by half of the projected population that we thought created for
sure.
us.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I think what's difficult about it is with the different studies we've done over the past few years, you know, the cost of growth study that we talked about and that came before you all, and I think it was October for cost of growth on the transportation system. We looked at different scenarios and we had an education outreach grant a couple of years ago that talked about generally cost associated with growth into expansion areas. You know, clearly we were already on like this kind of this razor thin edge of, boy, it's really expensive and how does it pencil? And so clearly what this is telling me at least is that, wow, the need is getting reduced by so much, especially based on just this new population projection that, as Beth alluded to, it may go down even further than that, depending on where the numbers all land. I am having continued conversations with the state of Oregon and the Population Research Center regarding some of these changes that we've made with our River Cherry Overlay District and some of the what we project to be as possibility with redevelopment rates. So, you know, it's kind of time is going to tell really what that final number is. And if that does go down further, obviously these numbers end up being reduced even more. But yeah, we definitely are seeing that the difference between 9,000 plus people down to 4,000 people has kind of wiped out the need piece based on those population projections.
Okay. That answers the question. Like I said, I just want to make sure I wasn't oversimplifying in my head or not seeing something. And I'll to my fellow planning commissioners, I'll say, in my opinion, that's an opportunity to just have bigger impact with the kind of strategies that we've been discussing. I wouldn't want to take this as an opportunity to rest, not that I think we would, but I would just say that I think this just makes the kind of strategies we were discussing have even more impact. I want to make sure that we're still talking about things like reducing parking requirements, talking about setbacks, all the different little changes that we could be making, increasing multi-use areas. Let's stick to the panic that we had about how are we gonna get 1,000 more units, and just know that we'll have bigger impact. So that's my personal opinion, but I'll just signal that to my fellow commissioners, saying that I would just as soon we keep the sense of urgency, and that's a signal to council and Madam Mayor as well. Thank you.
All right, let me go to Commissioner or Chair Lawyer. He had his hand up, and then Councillor Day, I think you have a question too. So go ahead, Chair Lawyer.
So Beth, one of the statements you made was that the population study numbers are not complete as of right now. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So I guess the question I have is, if we're in a position, so I know that SCATS has pushed back on these numbers, asking for a much more optimistic view of the overall population out forecast. And I know that there's other entities out there that are doing the same thing. So the numbers in theory could go up, they could go back down. What does that do for this? I mean, if we just accept this as is right now and the numbers go back up, then we're woefully unprepared. Or if the numbers go down, then kind of speaking of what Commissioner Watson was saying, we still have something to plan for. But I guess the question is, like, are we in a good space right now with this?
Well, first of all, with the final numbers, what Shane and I have agreed we'll do is, after the final numbers come out, we'll revise the housing needs analysis based on those final numbers. You couldn't adopt a housing needs analysis that uses this population forecast that we're using here, because it's not a final forecast. So, you know, if this forecast changed by one, so a minimal change, that would require some changes within the housing needs analysis. So we'll do that in July and August, okay, after the new numbers come out. Are you in a good place? I think if Kaiser thinks about, takes the approach that I think it was Commissioner Watson was talking about, and looks at the things that Kaiser can do to make development of housing more feasible, then that's going to put Kaiser in a better place. If Kaiser decided to take no action at all at this point, well, you're in a better place than you were in 2019 because you did the RCOD, certainly. There's probably more things that Kaiser can and may want to do. But I don't want to put words in your mouth and you know.
Well, if the population numbers go back the other way, I just don't want to be underprepared, I guess is my point.
I will say that I don't think they're going to go back the other way. Okay. The draft population numbers that we saw a week ago were lower than these. And then Shane's alluded to the fact that he's in discussions about that.
Okay. Thank you.
And part of that, Chair Lawyer, and I'll just offer this, you know, it is one of those pieces where, with the way that the methodology that's being used to do the population projections, while some communities can actually provide data that demonstrates a different growth rate based on things being built, Kaiser can't do that currently. And realistically, with the methodology that they're using, at least in part, and I am not a population forecaster, and it definitely is I'm a little out of my depth when I'm talking to the doctor of population forecasting at PSU. But I think that the reality is that there are some things that you're alluding to that clearly fall into that realm of policy type of decisions for planning commission and city councilors to weigh in on and give direction on. You know, the other thing we haven't really talked about, although we've talked about a lot of planning commission, is there's also other legislation coming down the road with House Bill 2001 and implementing new ordinance standards to allow for more of that middle housing type of development. I believe that, I don't know if it's a Senate bill or a House Bill 458, I think it passed, which is a bill that generally speaks to the ability to divide and parcelize middle housing types, which theoretically I think could provide a different product and a different entry point in the market for some buyers. It's geared toward that affordability factor. And, you know, I mean, realistically, over the course of the next few years, if we start seeing or if we adopt certain policies where we're getting additional units being produced, that may change the data that we're able to provide through the next round of population forecasting, and it may paint a little bit of a different story for us. So anyway, just some things to consider. And then the other, I think Councillor Day, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you. This is a housing needs analysis, but it doesn't, this is what we need, even though demand might be better. Would that be right, Ms. Goodman?
Housing need and housing demand are different things, certainly.
Okay. And because one of the things that I'm concerned about is the entry cost, the cost to get into a starter home. And that, of course, is, as an economist, you'd know, is supply and demand. So I guess what my question is how do you define need? Is need just to accommodate what we expect to be our population growth, or does need also include what we need to do in order to, you know, lower the cost of housing, you know, and rent burdens and all those other things for people to be able to get housing? I mean, is that brought into the equation in terms of determining what's needed?
So need is both land-based, which is what we're talking about here, and then it's affordability-based. So looking at overall Kaiser's need for housing, you have need for a wide range of housing types. And so you have need for single-family housing, certainly. The missing middle housing, which may be more affordable comparatively. The multifamily housing, which newly built, unless it's subsidized, isn't necessarily in that more affordable, that income restricted space, and then need for income restricted affordable housing. So it's for that whole range of things. If we want to get into talking about that a lot more, I would suggest after we finish with these questions that we start talking about the policies a little bit that you've got in your housing strategy. Did I answer your question enough for right now? Okay. Then I believe that Mr. Saldivar, sorry, I don't know if you're commissioner or city councilor.
Commissioner, this is more for our group, discussion. Even, you know, it shows a change, right? So we went from 2,200 something down to 210, but there's still, I guess, my concern is that even though it says we have land available so we can have capacity for 844 low density residential units, how likely is that the land that we have available is going to be able to do that? Because we've already discussed how we have this land there, but there's either policy issues or regulations or just the fact that it's not economically viable for a developer to come in and do that, or a homeowner isn't going to want to do it. So does this, that I assume that that assumption is not being addressed in this analysis?
No, Oregon's land use system, what you're talking about is essentially
what in Washington they call a market factor.
Right.
It's an acknowledgement that some land won't develop over the next 20 years.
Right.
In Washington, you can assume that 25% of land won't develop over the next 20 years. In Oregon, you do not have a market factor. It's not an assumption that you can make in a study like this. And so one must assume that all land that is vacant and unconstrained could develop over the next 20 years and is part of your estimate of capacity. If you remember, I said in the beginning that there are some parts of Oregon's land use system that don't make sense. That is, in my opinion, one of them.
I would disagree. There's lots of parts of Oregon's land use system that make absolutely no sense.
Well, I'm agreeing with you. This is one of those pieces. So,
So my point, I guess, for the group is that even though this is, I guess, good news in the sense that there isn't this, the deficit is decreased, there's still things that we can do, as been stated already, to help facilitate this 840, you know, what we think is buildable to make sure that that's possible. And the further point, I mean, I understand the difference between what we have to do and what we could be doing. I mean, if I built 1,000 homes in Kaiser, they would be sold. I have no doubt about that. Right. As a developer, there's no way I could, they'd be sold. It might take a year or two, but it's not 20 years. I mean, that's just, anybody who does anything with homes understands there's certain communities that people want to be a part of. And if you build homes in those communities, they're going to sell. And so regardless of how we like to coat what we need to do and what we want to do, I mean, there's also a decision on us as planners to determine how we want the city of Kaiser to look in 20 years from now, right? So there's a difference in how we look at it and saying, are we just going to get by? I'm confident, and I'm not an analyst, but if I built 1,000 homes in 20 years, that seems like not enough. I could build 1,000 homes in 2 years and fill them in the desire because people want to move to Kaiser. And that's just being limited by the sheer fact that we don't have the ability to provide more homes of any type from any of the economic stages to anybody to increase Kaiser. That's, I think, a major factor in why Kaiser's population is going to not grow so much in 20 years. There's just nowhere for anybody to go unless they want to live in the van down by the river or something like that. I'm done. Thank you.
Certainly. No,
yeah, I think, and I think you raise a really good point. And the one thing I will say, just as a kind of a commentary from Shane, I think you hit on one thing that I think is a good point to recognize for this group of folks is, whether or not the reduction in population is quote unquote a good thing or a bad thing. The one thing it does do in taking an optimistic kind of Pollyanna positive perspective with a reduced population projection is as opposed to the city having to react because of compulsory requirements of the state with less of a need being demonstrated, I feel that gives planning commission and council a little more flexibility to kind of drive what they want to do. Clearly, the other constraint is that, well, if you don't have the justification, big expansion is going to be very difficult to justify or pursue. But the flip side is we're not under compulsion to have to, completely go through and wipe out big swaths of Kaiser and rezone them into something that feels very different as a community, which kind of, harkens back to the 2009 visioning process we went through and those other things that are kind of long held things in the community. So, I mean, I think, I think it is hard because I think that for each person, it may feel differently whether or not this is a good thing or a bad thing. I think the hard part is with the way that Oregon land use planning system is and population projections that are hey, this is your number. We don't have a ton of choice about that, but we do have choice as to how we move forward and the policies we set and what we want to pursue with how to move the needle, whichever direction it is determined it wants to be moved. Anyway, just so for what it's worth, Commissioner Herb, you had your hand raised.
Yes. So I'll just comment on that. To me, it's always seemed like if you build it up, they will come. You know, if we expand our UGB up north and build 1,000 units of housing, like Francisco's saying, I feel like 1,000 people from Portland will come down and buy up those houses, and, you know, we'll have exhausted that that housing for people who already live here, have you. But my question was, we have the census coming out in September, and I'm wondering if that is going to play into anything, or if we just strictly use the PSU numbers.
You strictly use the PSU numbers. It's a requirement from the state. And I think a lot of the census results that we all want are some base information will be coming out in September. And I assume that PSU will use that information in updating their annual estimates of population in each household, in each city rather. And then when the next forecast comes around, that information should be used, that updated information.
Okay, thank you very much.
Certainly.
Councillor Johnson.
Attorney, I'm not a councillor, Shane.
Well, I didn't mean city councillor. A councillor with an S.
So I got to say first, I'm not really too great at math, but, and probably everybody else understands this, and I'm just lagging behind. The huge drop in dwelling units is obviously not due just to population. The population projections dropped by a little over half. Is the rest of the drop due to the RCOD and other efficiency measures, or is there something else driving that?
It's due to the RCOD.
Okay.
I would have unofficially attributed it to half to the RCOD, and maybe it's 40%, maybe it's 55%. I don't know. But a big part of it is the RCOD provides additional capacity. When we look up here, I think, I don't have the, maybe I have it in another slide here. Maybe I have it here. Let's see, 2019, we showed capacity for 1,300 dwelling units. Now we're showing capacity for 1,679. I'm not positive that I added up all of those numbers and updated that number, but I'll trust that it's about right. Your amount of land in your buildable lands inventory also decreased. So your capacity increased even though your buildable lands inventory decreased. And that's in large part because you can get a little more density in the RCOD, and in some places a lot more density. So yes, it's partially RCOD also.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Shall we go on to talk policy for a few minutes? All right, so these are the strategies that that were agreed upon back in the 2019 project. We'll update them with the updated information and reframe a few of them a little bit, you know, based on the fact that House Bill 2001 passed since these were done. But we're not planning on substantively changing these. The City Council could certainly do that. But we didn't have a public advisory committee, a project advisory committee this time. So we're honoring what the project advisory committee did last time. So strategic priority one about land supply and availability, a lot of the action out of that is coordinating with Salem to ensure there's sufficient capacity for the deficit. Priority two, encouraging a broader mix of housing types. A lot of that has to do with complying with House Bill 2001. Issue number three, this gets into the more interesting things, strategies to support affordable housing, and that's affordable for renters and owners at lower incomes and at middle incomes. So the strategies we have in there are about preserving your manufactured housing parks. Those provide affordable ownership housing, which is really rare. Evaluate reducing parking requirements. Partner on development and preservation of existing affordable housing. And then in priority number four, that's about identifying funding tools to support residential development, looking at things like creation of an urban renewal district that actually could be very, very powerful in your RCOD, given your new policies and your vacant land there and the opportunities probably for some redevelopment. Changes to your system development charges, consideration of imposition of a construction excise tax. I would say that for cities that aren't getting much housing development, a construction excise tax doesn't do a lot for them. But if you get into the point where you're able to get more development, a construction excise tax of 1% or less is one of the few flexible sources of funding that a city has for supporting affordable housing of different types. Looking at a local improvement district, and that'll be around infrastructure development and partnerships and for pursuing grants or loans to support some of the different things you need to do. So those are at the highest level some of the actions in the housing strategy. And that will, I assume, Shane, that'll come back to the city council and the planning commission over the next months.
Yes, that would be the plan.
And Madam Mayor, you have a question?
I do. Looking at the requirements for urban renewal districts and LIDs, local improvement districts, to be able to generate a certain increase in property value for doing those, doing the projects to pay for the infrastructure development, residential by itself doesn't pay the freight for just operations in general for the city. Does residential yeah. by itself pay the freight for urban renewal or other other types of funding tools? Or so would it have mixed use and higher value to help offset the losses that residential would generate?
Well, residential wouldn't necessarily generate a loss in urban renewal because what you're looking at, let's say you go from a single dwelling unit to a multifamily structure, let's just say a multifamily structure with 20 dwelling units in it, so nothing particularly big. You've got a lot more property tax revenue from the multifamily structure than you did from the single family structure. And that increment in property tax is the increment in the tax increment financing. And that's what drives the urban renewal district. Now, would you get more property tax from a mixed use building that was a little bit bigger than from the kind of residential building that I just described? My gut answer is quite probably. And this is why I was talking about this kind of development in the RCOD. And this, I think, is an opportunity to loop back to your question about economic development. Can you use some of your vacant land differently than what you're using it for? And I would say maybe. I mean, you could theoretically upzone some of your low density land to higher density. You don't have big pockets of low density land is kind of the problem. But you've got some medium density land here that's a little bit bigger. You've got some commercial and mixed use out here that you could look at using a little bit more intensely. And then you've got, I think, a discussion of what can Kaiser do around economic development, which in all honesty isn't something we've looked at here. It happens to be something that Shane wants to talk about and we're planning on talking about later on and having some discussion about that.
So I guess to kind of loop that back around, if we're talking about doing some sort of tax increment or urban renewal and so forth, the property taxes collected outside of that increment would not be able to pay for the services that would be required for.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that. That's why a city does an urban renewal feasibility study to figure out how feasible it is. And I am not an expert in urban renewal. I know experts in urban renewal, but I don't even play one on TV. So that's what your urban renewal feasibility study would be about.
Okay. And I hadn't heard about that interim step about doing a feasibility study, which makes a lot of sense to me. You have to do the math before you decide this is going to be a great thing to do.
We've not worth it.
Soup to nuts. This is going to make sense for the city as it is, and then what it would become, that we don't end up hurting ourselves in the process of trying to do something that we feel is good, but doesn't necessarily turn out well for everybody involved. So thank you, that was clarifying.
Certainly, and I would just say that your RCOD is what I interpret as an interesting place for that kind of tool to be used.
I would agree.
Are there other questions?
Okay, well, seeing that there's no other questions, Beth, thank you very much. Oh, you have next steps, sorry. We still have a little bit more to talk about. And the one thing I did want to kind of chime in on the urban renewal, the other thing I kind of want to remind everyone of is, you know, with that RCOD, that is something that when we did that revitalization plan, you know, the RCOD, we obviously adopted into our development code for some changes to the actual rules and regulations that govern that land. But that is something that was identified in the revitalization plan, as that in implementing the full kind of package of the revitalization plan, urban renewal was identified as one of those things that is likely something that needs to be looked at as an opportunity for financing some of those infrastructure needs and public investments. So anyway, go ahead, Beth.
I know that our next steps are looking at refining the housing needs analysis when we get the new numbers and getting it back to you with the city in August. And you may see me again if Shane thinks that that would be helpful in August. And then if there's coordination with Salem, you know, continuing that. And if the city chooses to adopt the housing needs analysis, that might will be adopted in fall 2021. And certainly the city needs to, if it's intending to adopt it, you need to notice it before the end of the year, so we lock in the population forecast and the planning period. So that's all I had for y'all.
All right, well, are there any final questions for Beth while we have her? And if not, Beth, thank you very much. Great job, and it was obviously very informative and helpful, and that is really all that I have for you all tonight.
Actually, Shane, can we get a copy of that PowerPoint?
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. Yes, I will. Debbie, can you send that out to everybody on the Zoom? Okay. So, yeah, we will send that all out to you all. And then I would ask, hey, if you go through and you have some specific questions, if you want to just get those to me, I'll coordinate with Beth. We'll get answers answered the best we can. And yes, thank you for that reminder, Councillor Day. Commissioner Lawyer, Chair Lawyer.
Yeah, the only thing I'd say, Shane, is I just want to say you've already started implementing a lot of the strategies so far. I think the commission has been encouraged and accepting of most, if not all, of what you brought forward. But what I'd say is for those people that aren't on the commission or on the council that this is important to, please pay attention to our meetings, show up. We do up, we have public hearings on all of these items as they're coming in. So if this is something that people feel really, really strongly about and you want to talk about the importance of the fabric of the community moving forward, you either need to write in the public comment period time or come in and provide testimony. Shane does a great job. I think our commission is, working hard to try to take what Shane gives us, but if there's thoughts or ideas out there, I know that the rest of the commissioners and myself, I would assume, really would like to hear from that, and ultimately that's going to provide a better response and recommendation to the city council. So Shane, thanks for all the hard work you've done on this already, trying to implement things from the last time we discussed this and through the RCOD process and all that stuff. So that's all I got.
Again, I don't know how to raise my hand here, but anyway, to me, the biggest question is, how do we really move forward? How do we really do this? And you know, all these numbers and all these studies and all this stuff is all great, but how do we do it? How is there anything we can actually do that's not 20 years away?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I mean, I think at some level, it depends on what council and planning commission and the community want to do. I think that's really the million-dollar question. You know, if the answer is we want to grow aggressively, then clearly the data is not really supporting that currently. If it is, hey, we want to kind of embrace how we've been and improve how we are at an incremental rate, then I think that we're, obviously that's a little bit easier to do. But yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I don't, sorry, I'm just the planning director.
Well, if I could chime in, this is going to go to that larger conversation about not just the residential in isolation, but the economic fabric as a whole, because we're going to have to look at the nexus of jobs and services, as well as residential, across the fabric of Kaiser, and then how that interplays with Salem. Because we are completely joined together as we are, we're not making these decisions in, as if we were a city unto ourselves, which puts us in a very unique position in terms of planning and opportunity. We can really take time to think about what we believe is going to create the most balanced city in all of those areas going forward. So yes, we have some incredible housing needs. There's no question about it. I hear it all the time as the chair of the Homeless Alliance. And we've got to be able to address comprehensively how we are providing housing. But clearly, when you're looking at how little we have to work with, and that's been by state design, we've got to approach it totally differently than any other city in the state, except ones that are completely landlocked physically. We're landlocked. I can't think of a better word, hypothetically. Obviously, we have room with there's land, but we don't want to. We have the best hops land on the planet. Why would anybody develop that for something that, for a lesser use? So those are the conversations that commissioners and counselors and our community are going to have to think through. And that's going to be the challenge for us, I think.
Yeah, thank you. And I did want to just let everybody know, we did have, looks like Carol Dorfler and Mike DeBlasi have been listening in and attending. And Carol and Mike, I see you. Mike, I see your question in the Q&A, and I'm going to go ahead and get that over to our consultant, and I will get back to you on that question. Yeah, I think from my end, I think I'm done talking. I don't need to talk anymore tonight, so I'm good.
Okay, well, if there is nothing else from the City Council, the time is 7:25 and we are adjourned. Mr. Lawyer?
And if there's nothing else from the Commission, it's 7:25 and we will adjourn.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Welcome, everyone.